I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In 2016, it was lock her up. In 2019, it's send her back. President Trump and his supporters continue to find new ways to polarize the country. If the president's campaign rally in Greenville, North Carolina last week is any indication, over the next 18 months, Mr. Trump will welcome a level of racial animus and intolerance that exceeds the shocking levels he introduced in his last campaign. Michael Cruz is a senior staff writer at Politico who attended the Greenville rally. Andrea McDaniels is a member of the editorial board of the Baltimore Sun. Dr. Barudi Capano is the chair of the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. They join me. Trump, race, and American tolerance for intolerance. That's next on Midday, after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. In a tweet on Sunday morning, the 14th of July, President Donald Trump directed his ire toward four freshman congresswomen known as the Squad. In a series of tweets that included the sentence, quote, "Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came?" 4 days later, at a campaign rally in Greenville, North Carolina, at the mention of one of those congresswomen, the president presided over a crowd in full fervor, chanting, "Send her back." It was chilling. By now, as you've been reminded ad nauseum over the last week, you probably know that only one of the four representatives, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, was born in a foreign country. She was born in Somalia and immigrated to the U.S. as a teenager. The other three, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Representative Ayanna Pressley, and Representative Rashida Tlaib, are from New York, Massachusetts, and Michigan, respectively. Given the brazenness and brutishness of the president's racist tweets and statements last week, and the reaction or lack of reaction that they engendered in the public square, what should we make of the fact that the duly elected leader of our country is more than comfortable laying bare his conviction that people of color are somehow less capable and less desirable? The "go back where you came from" taunt is one in a long, long series of demeaning comments by Mr. Trump aimed at non-white people. And it appears to be part of a deliberate strategy to speak to those white voters who hold people of color in the same contempt as the president does. Today on Midday, a conversation about not just the tweets and the president's subsequent statements, but the statements and policies that the president has made heretofore as well, and the reaction. What do you think of the tweets, the response from both Democratic and Republican lawmakers, and the way the president's view of people of color has been characterized in the media, including by me and my guests over the past week or so, in particular on this program? You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. We begin today with Michael Cruz. He's a senior staff writer at Politico, and he joins us on the line from San Francisco. Michael, welcome.
Greetings. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks. Tell us about the room. You were at the rally in Greenville last Thursday. Before we talk about the content of Mr. Trump's remarks, tell us about, you know, prior to Mr. Trump taking the stage. What was the vibe?
Well, the vibe started outside in the, you know, nearly 100-degree heat. The best-selling merchandise was, in some sense, setting the stage for what we would see that evening: shirts with very similar sentiments, you know, "love it or leave it," "let me help you pack," "build the wall, deport them all," and other slogans that we probably shouldn't say on a nice civilized radio program like this one. So the crowd waiting to go inside that pretty tight, you know, 8,000-seat arena was pumped up, ready to go, and ready to respond the way that they did and the way that we all know they did by now.
So Adam Swerer, who writes for The Atlantic, has covered, as you have, a number of these rallies. He says that this one really was different, that there is this was an inflection point. Do you hold that view as well?
The way I saw it, and in that moment, I mean, I should say that that moment was not even close the most, in some way, authentic moment of the night, most visceral, most guttural moment of the night. And when I got back to the hotel to write what I wrote and watch some of those the clips of that moment, it's not the way it felt during that moment and inside that building. It was a much more intense chant than even was conveyed in those video clips. But in that moment, I thought to myself, you know, this is the true start of the 2020 election campaign. Obviously, the president filed for re-election on the day of his inauguration. He had had a rally in Orlando the month before to officially kick off his 2020 campaign, but this felt like the actual start. It felt like a preview of what the language is going to be, what the tenor is going to be of this campaign, and it shouldn't really come as a surprise to people because this is in keeping with a track record for Donald Trump that goes back literally almost half a century.
Looking back at it, is there any way of determining how this started? I mean, I'm not sure any of us are specifically aware of how Lock Her Up started in the 2016 campaign, but had anybody hinted at this kind of rhetoric, the send her back phrase, you know, earlier in the evening? You mentioned, you know, that there were T-shirts and MAGA merchandise that, you know, reflected those comments. Go ahead, let me help you pack, all that kind of stuff. Was there any precursor or any indication that that was going to become the signature moment of the night?
Not to me, and not that I've heard subsequently, and not that I've seen subsequently, but wasn't too far from the kind of language we had seen leading up to that rally, the 3 or 4 days prior to that rally, but also, let's be honest, the prior 3 or 4 years heading to that rally, 3 or 4 decades heading to that rally. So I don't know where this started, and it sort of depends on what you mean by this.
Well, I guess the rhetoric itself, that particular phrase, send her back, was it at all calculated? Is there any evidence to suggest that it was calculated by someone on the campaign or someone, by anybody?
I mean, I can't say that affirmatively and with any specificity. Mm-hmm. You know, it does rhyme with some of the language we had seen. And it's also, you know, lock her up, send her back. These are easily chantable slogans. I mean, they're, in their perverse way, quite catchy.
You write about Mr. Trump's perpetual calculated conflict, the fact that he revels in perpetuated and calculated conflict, but it is always specifically race-laced and contains foils and feuds. So Hillary Clinton was the foil the last time and can't play that role again. So it does seem that it was calculated on Mr. Trump's part to single out these congresswomen, the four freshman congresswomen, as this campaign's version of the enemy.
You know, it's true. We will see who comes out of the Democratic primary and who will be on the opposite side in the general election. I'm sure he will do what he does with that person, to that person, or try. But for now, those four congresswomen are, for him, I mean, as unacceptable as it might be, they are incredibly useful foils, and they are the latest in a long line of a series of racially charged, if not outright racist, tactics employed by Donald Trump, both in his political ascent and also before his political ascent.
Michael Cruz is a senior staff writer at Politico. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about the rally that President Trump held last week in Greenville, North Carolina. In terms of allocation of time spent on various subjects, you write that he spoke for an hour and a half. How much time did he spend talking about Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, et cetera, as compared to talking about these four congresswomen who've come to be known as the Squad?
Yeah, briefly and in passing and almost parenthetically, They were afterthoughts, people who might actually be on the opposite side of the general election. He spent far, far more time on the four congresswomen, and in particular, Representative Ilhan Omar. I mean, he stuck with her for five-plus minutes. Depends on how you want to run the clock. But he introduced her first, notably first, by name, of course, and stayed on that subject for quite some time, which felt like a very long time in the room. And toward the end of that span, that is when the send her back chants started, first a little bit, and then it sort of picked up steam. And he stepped away from the podium, stepped away from the lectern, and let them go. I mean, obviously he's tried to walk that back and rewrite history since then, but that is just not the way it played out. He let it happen, and he let people listen to that and join in on that.
What kind of place is Greenville, North Carolina? About 90,000 people, but it's a college town as well. What kind of spot is it?
Yeah, Greenville proper is actually a place that did not vote for Donald Trump. The county as a whole, Pitt County, is a place that went for Hillary Clinton. Surrounding, of course, is very red, very rural eastern North Carolina. But Greenville specifically is a higher education center in eastern North Carolina. It's a healthcare hub. It's the healthcare hub of eastern North Carolina. And in every way, Greenville, North Carolina is, you know, the de facto capital of the eastern third of that quite wide, varied swing state. So the people who were in that arena weren't just from Greenville. I mean, they were from all over eastern North Carolina and beyond. But it is a smart place, politically speaking, for President Trump to have had his second re-election rally. Florida obviously is super important, and he was there for his rally in Orlando. But North Carolina is a state that, one of a handful of states that could and almost certainly will determine whether he can win in 2020. And in terms of that state, he's not going to go to Charlotte. It's not a place that is going to welcome them, even though, of course, the RNC is going to be there next summer. And most of the other metropolitan areas in North Carolina are also not particularly Trump-friendly. This is a pattern that holds true for almost everywhere, coast to coast. But eastern North Carolina is the most Trump-rich, Trump-loving, generally speaking, part of politically very important North Carolina.
Yeah, you mentioned that Charlotte will be the place for the Republican convention next summer. The Charlotte City Council, which is majority Democratic, passed a resolution condemning the president's remarks in Greenville across the state. It's also, there's a fairly large, you write about this in your piece in Politico, fairly large Latino migrant community. What were your interactions with some of the folks in that community?
Yeah, they were. They've been anxious, of course, and they were anxious even on that day. Talked to people throughout the Latino community in Greenville, including some businesses literally right across the street from the airport where Air Force One landed, and business was down in certain establishments. People just sort of staying inside, not wanting to get caught up in checkpoints. I mean, not a thing that happened, but an understandable fear and anxiety. But, this day was but, another day in a series of days for this community in Greenville, and in many places for that matter, marked by unease, to say the least. Talked with on the phone when I was in Greenville with an undocumented high school student, and he described, of course I didn't name him, that was the condition for the phone call, but he described a life for his family over the last couple of years that is basically their shut-ins in their trailer in a nearby town, just too fearful to go outside too many times and for too long because of not only certain policies and potential of ICE raids, but frankly just the rhetoric and the atmosphere that is prevalent throughout the last few years of the Trump administration.
Before we let you go, one last quick question. You write very eloquently, I think, that talking about the rally, it was the extemporaneous product of an attention-seeking, room-reading savant, an instinctual gauger and tweaker and torker of crowds. Is Donald Trump getting better at this this time around than he was 2016? We hear the old adage, practice makes perfect. He's had a lot of practice. Is he really perfecting this art?
I mean, hard for me to quantify how much better he has gotten, if that's the right way to put it, since 2016. I think he was already very good at this particular skill. He has always been attuned to what the populace wants, not what they necessarily say they want, but what they really, really want. I mean, this is a lifetime project of his. Hasn't always been political, of course, but more political than people think, than people consider, really. But he's always been good at this, and I've spent years at this point reporting on him and studying him and learning about him, and this is undoubtedly one of the skills that has helped him make political hay over these last few years. He is looking for what gets a response, and then he goes to that. And to some extent, of course, every politician needs to do some version of this, but I do think he is particularly, again, it's a strange way to put it, but I do think he's particularly good at this. And he gives people what they want, or a certain number of people. The question, of course, as it was in 2016 and as it will be in 2020, is what is the number of those people, and where do those people live, and is it going to be enough to win the Electoral College?
Yeah, how big is that number? Michael Cruz is a senior staff writer at Politico. Michael, I appreciate it. You're in San Francisco covering the Kamala Harris campaign. We look forward to reading about that.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, more on the president's racial views, the views of the voters who support him, the reaction to Mr. Trump by his political allies in Congress, and how his statements have been characterized in the media. I'll be joined by Dr. Barudi Kapano of Morgan State University and Andrea McDaniels, an editorial writer for the Baltimore Sun. We will take your calls and comments at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. You can also follow us on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, WIPR will bring you coverage of Robert Mueller's testimony before two congressional committees. Our coverage will start around 8:30 tomorrow morning and continue throughout the day. Midday will be back again on Thursday, when my guests will be the filmmaker Emily Stubb and the organizer and activist Anthony Francis from Harlem Park here in Baltimore. We'll talk about food deserts in Baltimore and what the Harlem Park community is doing to address that longstanding problem. Plus, Jaywin Russick will have her weekly theater review. So that's Thursday. And then on Friday here on Midday, during the Midday News Wrap, we'll have more coverage and analysis of the Mueller hearings. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about racism in American politics, President Trump's desire to fan the flames of intolerance, and the political calculations of his allies and his opponents. Joining me now in Studio A, Andrea McDaniels, a member of the editorial board of the Baltimore Sun. Andrea, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Barudi Kapano, he's an associate professor and the chair of the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. Barudi, good to see you as well, sir.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What did you think about the goings-on this past weekend, the goings-on in Greenville, North Carolina, during that rally that Mr. Trump held, and the subsequent statements that people on both sides of the political aisle have made? 410-662-8780. That's our phone number. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. And we are also streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Andrea, to a certain extent, part of this conversation comes down to how one defines racism. The word racist and racism has been, you know, top of mind for everybody. On the one hand, racism seems like a pretty simple thing to understand and identify. On the other hand, it's been turned around a little bit in this past conversation. What's your take on what's happened over these last 10 days?
I think we all know what racism is, and it's easy to flip it when you don't want to appear as a racist. And that's what people are doing. They're flipping it because they don't want Donald Trump to appear as a racist. But he's shown his true colors from the beginning, from calling Carol Moseley Braun stupid, from calling LeBron James stupid, from calling African countries, SHIT, whole countries. He's shown his true colors from the beginning. And the people that are saying they don't know what racism is know what it is, and they're trying, I don't know, to protect Donald Trump, to make it appear as if he is not what he is and what he has shown to be that he is.
Yeah, this didn't happen last week. This goes back a long time.
Right, before
Central Park
he was president.
5, way before he was president. And as Michael Cruz from Politico alluded to, he's thought about being president for a long time. There's strong evidence that he was thinking about it in the 1980s, I mean, even running as a third-party candidate. Rudy Capano, what does this mean? I mean, are we at an inflection point in the United States of America where in 2019, a overtly intolerant racist person has been elected president of the United States?
Well, I'll go back to your first question. I'm not sure we all agree on what racism is. And I think that really is part of the problem. I think inherent in any definition, at least that I use, of racism, we are addressing issues of power. We are attacking the foundation of this country. We are talking about privilege that has been bestowed to certain classes of people. And I think that's a discussion that's extremely difficult for folks to have. We've not addressed it. We've not done what South Africa has done by calling for a truth and reconciliation commission to examine our past so that we truly, and to be accountable for that past, so that we can truly move forward and progress. We've not done that. So by not doing that, we create an environment where that racism is not gone away. It did not go away because Obama became the president. It was stewing in the background.
We have to account for our present, too.
Yes.
There are people who simply don't think there's anything wrong with the rhetoric that the president has used for not just this past couple of weeks, but for, you know, all of his public career. How does one respond, Andrew? I mean, how does one respond to someone who says, oh, it's not racist? Or Mr. Trump himself trying to literally turn around by saying that, you know, Representative Omar and Ocasio-Cortez are themselves racist. But the theory is, I guess you say it and maybe repeat it enough times and there's a certain contingent who's going to believe it's true just because they hear it?
I mean, people are going to believe, you know, what they want to hear. And what Donald Trump is doing is he's keeping it in the news. He flip-flops, says, I didn't mean it's racist, then I mean it is. And what he's actually trying to do is appeal to his base and I don't know, remind and make his base think that we're almost running against these four congresswomen and not, you know, and not the candidates who are really running against him. I mean, the day that he started with this rhetoric, Joe Biden announced a new health care plan, but we all forgot about that because he kept the focus on the four congresswomen. So he's spinning and he's appealing to his base, and it's working with his base.
Let's go to the phones to Mark in Frederick. Mark, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling. Mark, are you there in Frederick?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I was just having, I guess, a pretty robust discussion with your call screener. So I'll give you a bottom line up front. I read the article, listened to your news, you know, the recent interview, and I think I took exception to the fact that you're portraying, from a rally, you're portraying a lot of people who support President Trump and the change in policies and direction for this country, all right, with really, you know, terms that are easily thrown around, whether you want to or not, if it's racism, bigotry, whatever. What I was explaining to your call screener was, in Maryland, for example, we have lost a generation of young men that should be learning the trades, and coming up through the trades. And because of heroin, poor education, all the above, all kinds of external factors, lack of good family structure, that they come to the job site ill-prepared, all right? They won't do a job. Yet I can bring in an illegal alien or an alien on a particular type of visa and have them work for me. If they're illegal, it's cash, all right? And Maryland does the wink and the nod and looks the other way, but they'll come down on my ass if I don't, you know, if something goes wrong, let's say. So I'm very clear with documenting everything and making sure that they do what they have to do for a job and that they're paid fairly for a job. But aside from that, I took exception with the fact that the example in North Carolina, especially with the rally and the rhetoric, you're using that to paint a broad picture of those of us who voted and support the president and his policies because of the failed previous policies that really put me through a trying time with my business, what I do for a living. All right? And where we are today, whether that rhetoric, whether people take that rhetoric to heart or not, let me ask you this. Did anyone actually act on that rhetoric? No.
Well, I appreciate your calling, Mark. And there are a couple of things that I want to say in response, but I'm going to let Baroudi talk first. And I thank you for that call. And stay on the line, because there are some things that I'd love to unpack about what you've just said.
Yeah, I would say that the rhetoric is dangerous. We have the example of two members of a police department in Louisiana, in fact, who were fired. One was fired for posting on Facebook. He called Representative Ocasio-Cortez a vile idiot and suggested that she be shot. So for that, he was fired, and his fellow police officer was shot for liking that post. So we're in a space where the rhetoric is being behaved on. And when the president was alerted that his rhetoric was emboldening to many of the white nationalists, he said that wasn't his problem. He was not interested in that.
Wait a minute. So what you just said, let's use the example of the Republican congressman wounded and shot at a softball practice a couple years ago. And the rhetoric on the Bernie Sanders side, okay? Fair is fair. But you're not seeing on the Trump supporting side people actually doing this. I mean, you have more.
Yeah, well, Mark, fair is fair, but it's horrible for Steve Scalise to be shot. It's horrible for anybody to be threatened. The death threats against Ilhan Omar in Minnesota, the death threats against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are easily documented. I sincerely hope that someone says that POS to Allah the donkey pig monkey god. That's a tweet. Ilhan needs to be hung. She's a traitor and a threat to the West. She's a pedophile loving Muslim. This is a person whose Twitter handle is 100% Trump. Put that bitch down hard. I think someone should do something to Ilhan. Clearly, she thinks it's okay for some people to do some things. American Patriot Twitter handle. What do you think, girls? Rope tree. These are real threats, creating. Mark. These are real threats.
Right, real threats, but people are threatening on both sides. And so let's agree this. The rhetoric should come down, right? But I'll agree with that. But fair is fair. My part of my original call to the screener was NPR and WYPR have to do a better job bringing on a balanced approach and balanced story. So you bring in a very good story about what happened in Greenville. I have empathy for those illegal and legal aliens and people who feel possibly that they're not assimilated or part of the culture down there. Mm-hmm. I do. I truly believe that that's an issue.
Yeah, okay? And Mark, let me interrupt for a second, because I got to tell you, you're exactly right that this conversation is one-sided in that respect. I can't disagree with you at all, and that's by design. Because for me, and this is I'm first to come clean about this. For me, it is not a matter of contention as to whether or not the president's rhetoric was racially tinged and racist. How do you respond, for example, to Gene Robinson in the Washington Post, who writes the following: anybody tempted to support Mr. Trump because of his economic or foreign policies should be constantly reminded that this is not an a la carte menu. If you plan to vote for Mr. Trump, because of his tax cuts, for example, or his uncritical support of Israel, you're also voting for his racism. If you support Mr. Trump,
apply the same standard to the previous president and the presidential candidates, current and past, on both sides, and apply it to the current congressmen and women serving, as well as the senators. Okay,
so do you condone Mr. Trump's racism?
She's selective. She's pointing out, oh, he's the president, leader of the free world, what have you. Good. But you want to know something? The vile and the issues that have been created and constant over the last 3 years, if she's that blind to the fact that that's been going on for 3 years, all right, then yes, there's this, there's a simmering anger, resentment, whatever. But you know what? Most Trump supporters, we laugh. I'm telling you right now, we laugh at it. And we do see that the four congresswomen who were recently, you know, what are they? I just forgot the name that they gave them, but even that's derogatory.
The squad, yeah. All right. Well, Mark, I appreciate the call and appreciate your listening and appreciate the call. It's always good to get that perspective. Thank you so much.
Of assimilation to our American traditions and culture.
All right. Well, Mark, we're going to have to let you go. We've spent a lot of time on your comments. How the media covers this, Andrew McDaniels, is very, very important. I have been very upfront about the fact that it's just this behavior is not acceptable. It's wrong. I don't care whether it's normal or not. It's just wrong. And I would just feel untrue and inauthentic if I didn't make my own view known about this. Can I be objective about Mr. Trump? Am I a poor reporter on Mr. Trump, given that I'm pretty upfront about what I think?
So, you know, on the editorial pages at the Baltimore Sun, we've taken him on for months now, from even in our last editorial, you know, comparing him to a grand wizard. From the news side, their perspective is, you know, we cover it as a news story, and that the editorial pages are the opinion. But I think news has some obligation in some way to call him out on what he's saying and on the rhetoric that he's using.
And Brudy Capano, I was really interested. I happened to watch CBS Evening News on Monday night, the day after the original tweets. It was Nora O'Donnell's first night as the anchor. Weijia Yang, who's the White House correspondent, was standing in front of the South Lawn and, you know, for the stand-up. And they referred to the tweets that had happened the day before as racist tweets. No qualification, no ambiguity about it. And there were many others in mainstream and lesser-known media outlets who made that decision, too. That seemed to me to be a different thing than in months past. Did it strike you as a new moment in media?
Well, I would just say this, that I believe objectivity and the media and the press is an ideal. It's an aspiration. It's a model. I don't think we've ever had it. The Poynter Institute, which is a journalism research organization, conducted a study. Mark Pinsky actually is the author of the study. And the study looked at Southern newspapers over a 150-year period. And the title of the study is Maligned in Black and White, Southern Newspapers Played a Major Role and Racial Violence. And then the question that's a part of the title is, do they owe their communities an apology? So, I mean, obviously we don't have the time to go into full detail, but there is a very detailed documented history where media outlets, they absolutely took a position. They took a position sometimes by not taking a position. And, you know, to quote Dr. King, I think there is a point where our silence becomes betrayal, that we are obligated. It's not just the issue of racism that Trump is highlighting. It is the very fabric of what American democracy is supposed to be. The ability to criticize the government, the ability to have freedom of speech and of press, of the religion. Here are the very infringements that this behavior is threatening. So, on the one hand, he's hiding behind the cloak of patriotism to mask his own racism. But what could be more patriotic than invoking your First Amendment rights, the Bill of Rights as a totality, the very things that he's threatening?
We'll talk about that after A quick break. Dr. Barudi Cappano chairs the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. Andrea McDaniels is an editorial writer at the Baltimore Sun. You're welcome to join us here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We're streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I am particularly interested in hearing from those of you who support the president. If you support the policies of the president, does it mean, can we infer that you also support his view of racial tolerance, which seems to be unequivocally racist to a lot of folks? I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1. WYPR.
The president ran a campaign that could be summarized in two words: America first. There's a huge difference between America first and an ideology that runs down America. If you want to sum up,
you don't think that you don't think the president ran down lock her up. The president is not American. Nobody has any problem with what the president's policies have been. It's when he goes into stoking racial fears. I've never called any of his tweets racist, but there's no question that he is stoking racial divisions.
I'm Tom Hall, and I have called some of Mr. Trump's tweets racist, for the record. This is Midday. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the racial invectives hurled by the president and those who support his brand of nationalism and the response or lack thereof to his numerous racist statements and tweets. That clip we just heard was an exchange between Chris Wallace of Fox News and senior policy advisor Stephen Miller on the racially divisive attacks on the four congresswomen that we've talked about, known as the Squad. You are welcome to join us here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. My guests here in Studio A, Dr. Barudi Cappano, the chair of the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University, and Andrea McDaniels, a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun, who now writes editorials for that paper, which focus largely on social justice, race, and health. So, Andrea, it strikes me that there were more news outlets calling the tweets themselves and the rhetoric specifically racist without qualifiers. And it did take a long time for a lot of folks in the media to even use the term lie to talk about Mr. Trump's stretching the truth, manipulating the truth, telling half-truths. I mean, do you think the media is sort of warming up to less qualified characterizations of this rhetoric?
Yes, I think as it gets worse and worse and worse, you can't ignore it. You have to call it out and say that he is lying. I mean, at some point, you just can't ignore it, and you can't sugarcoat it. Make it seem less than it is.
Yeah, Wall Street Journal, their headline said that tweets that some lawmakers decried as racist. Bloomberg ran the headline, "Trump called racist after tweaking go back." In other words, people have called him racist, or the comments were racially tinged, or the comments were racially controversial, rather than saying they are racist. People magazine said Trump slammed as racist in chief after he tweets about the congressional women of color. There were some people on Fox News who were sort of laughing about it, thinking that it was, you know, kind of cute and kind of, isn't that Donald being Donald? And, he tells it like it is. We heard a lot about that back in the 2016 campaign. It's so troubling on a fundamental level, Barudi. It's just that this is the level of rhetoric that we have. This is the kind of rhetoric specifically designed to have some people agree and some people not agree.
And the other thing that is really troubling to some is that there's the fear that Trump's rhetoric is setting an international tone in terms of political racism. So that when you see the president of Brazil, literally being emulating the same kind of rhetoric you have coming from Donald Trump. And in fact, some people refer to him as Trump of the tropics. Yeah. Donald Trump of South America, even with what we think was going to be for sure the new prime minister of the United Kingdom, that there's a brashness about him that many people think is
Boris Johnson, and he has in fact been announced as the winner of that of that race. Yeah. Let's go to the phones to Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Clarence, always nice to hear from you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I'm gonna be brief. I like the conversation first and foremost. I'm a 70-year-old African American man. I grew up in the South. I had a brother that was lynched in South Carolina. To your previous caller, a Trump supporter, you cannot change their mind. But what I do, I listen to every speech that he gives. And 4th of July, I didn't know that we had airports during the Revolutionary War. Yesterday, world leaders are starting to call him out as being a liar. And I say to all of his supporters, I wish you could take my place of being a person of color and the insults that I have incurred since this man has taken the office at 1600. I do not consider him to be a president. He's a coward. He talks about African Americans, but he didn't even come to the conference yesterday. So those are my comments.
Well, thank you, Clarence.
Thanks for taking my call.
I do appreciate it. And let's go to one of those Trump supporters, to Andrea in Baltimore. Andrea, thanks so much for calling. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, I wanted to say that when the president was talking about what the five Congress members said, he was referring to what they said, not about their skin hue and not about their gender. So he's really, this isn't racism when you talk about what someone says and thinks. That would be about the content of their character. Racism is about the color of their skin. So I don't understand why people assume it's racism when he's actually responding to what they think.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Andrew. What about the fact that he said, go back to where you came from?
I think he's saying the door is open. If you don't like it here, you can leave. Lots of people said they were going to leave if he got elected. People are free to leave. They could come back. I know some people who became expatriates, not entirely because of President Trump, but in part. It's good when you have the luxury of being able to choose where you want to live.
Okay.
Three of the four congresswomen were born here. I mean that's a ridiculous stance to take. When did our ability or right to question the government earn us a deportation ticket from this country? That is supposed to be a fundamental right that every American has. And in these cases, these four duly elected representatives are American citizens. They have the right. In fact, because they are elected officials, they have the responsibility to challenge, to ask questions. We have the right to disagree, but they have that right.
And not to mention that President Trump ran his first campaign on criticizing America and criticizing the government. Make America great again. He didn't like how America was, and that's what he ran his first campaign on. Nobody told him to go back where he came from. Nobody told his supporters to go back where he came from. He didn't point out the race of these congresswomen, but the way he did it, you knew he was talking about race. These four black congresswomen, the people that he attacks are always people of color. So he may not say race, but the way that he presents his rhetoric, the way that he presents what he's saying, you know he's talking about race.
Yeah, so Andrea, I really would love to. Are you still with us, Andrea? Nope. It looks like we've lost Andrea.
No, I'm still here.
Oh, good. Is it coincidence that those four congresswomen are people of color? I mean,
I think it's the best example of how great the American experiment is, that as we continue in our path, we elect people that we wouldn't have elected 50 years ago, 10 years ago, 250 years ago. I don't think it matters what their color is. It matters how you think.
And is it okay to think, to disagree with the policy and the perspective of the party in power or the president in power?
Oh, absolutely. Dissent is completely American.
Right.
That's so, what I'm saying. This is not racism. It's simply dissent. They're allowed to think how they want to think. He'll think how he wants to think. And he's judging them on what they're saying, which is what blacks and women have wanted all these years.
All right, well, thanks for that.
Judged on what we're saying, not on what other people assume we ought to say based on our skin hue or our gender.
Well, I appreciate the perspective. Thanks for calling, Andrew. I really do. Let's go to Stephen Tillett in Severn. Stephen, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. How are you today?
Fine, sir. Welcome to the show.
There's an old expression, when somebody shows you who they are, believe them. Donald Trump has shown us who he is over the course of his public life. And so the fact that he is a person of no moral character should not be a surprise to us. The fact that, you know, he still says that the young men in Central Park who were wrongly apprehended and wrongly charged and wrongly jailed, DNA evidence proved that it could not have been them, and he's still talking about they should be executed. So we know who he is. But my concern is that we would focus, not allow ourselves to be distracted. All this stuff is a distraction. Right now, we need to be focusing on what Robert Mueller has to say in the next couple of days, and the Democratic candidates, rather than wasting their good campaign airtime talking about what he has to say. Was what he said racist? Yes, absolutely. Now, let's talk about what he's doing to the EPA. Let's talk about what DeVos is doing in education. Let's talk about the report that just came out that they are going to take 3 million people off the rolls for SNAP benefits. Those are the things that matter. And if we remember that his supporters are outnumbered, he's never polled more than 44-45%. He's only in the White House because of the Electoral College. Thank you, 17th century, 18th century.
Yeah.
That's the only reason he's there. He lost the election. Focus on the things that matter, the policies that matter, and get rid of this guy.
I appreciate that, Pastor Tillett. Thank you so much. Andrew Downs, this is a point you made earlier in the show. I mean, this is a distraction to a certain extent. We're not talking about certain things. 88% of Democrats polled, likely voters in the primary, are concerned mostly about health care. They're not concerned about this. But should we be concerned about a man who is racially intolerant being the president of the United States? What else can we do? What else should be done in this moment before the election? You know, we're still a year and a half away from the election to counter this argument.
Right. I mean, we have to cover what he says. We have to cover, you know, race. But we also do need to be careful not to fall into what he's trying to do. And that is, you know, create this image that these four, what he describes as radical women, are the face of the Democratic Party, and when they're not, and we also have to balance that with the issues and the issues that are important.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't let him, you know, we can't fall into his game. It's definitely important.
We are running out of time. Let me go to Michael in Laurel. Michael, welcome to Midday. What's your real quick comment? We're almost out of time.
I'd just like to ask your panelists, those of us in the middle who are socially liberal but more fiscally conservative than the Democratic Party, we feel stuck between the fiscal irresponsibility of the left and a lot of the freebie giveaway type programs that are constantly being talked about in the Democratic primary, and the kind of fake corporate cronyism, conservatism of the Republicans. We don't have an option.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, Michael, and thanks for the call. I mean, the marginalization of the middle.
Right. I mean, I don't have much more to say than that. But I will say this, in conclusion for me at least, that what Donald Trump is doing in terms of using race, that's not anything that's new to him.
Not new.
All right? So when we go—
Not only to him, but it's not new to a bunch of other people.
It's not new to the party. So when you go back to the Papa Bush and his use of Lee Atwater and invoking the issue of race as it relates around Willie Horton and the whole issue of being soft on crime as a way to defeat Dukakis, this is a known trope. Folks know that they don't have to use the word sometimes. They never have to say race. They never have to do that. But they use all the buzzwords that let folks know that they really are talking about race.
Dr. Barudi Kapano is an associate professor and chair of the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. Andrea McDaniels writes editorials for the Baltimore Sun, which focus on social justice, race, and health. Thank you both so much for coming in. I very, very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, gavel-to-gavel coverage of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's long-anticipated testimony before Congress. WYPR will carry NPR's coverage of the Mueller hearings all day, beginning at 8:30 tomorrow morning. That's it for us today. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find menu and hours at joesquared.com. Here and Now is up next after the news from NPR at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.